Hello there, Meta Nerds community. We are starting a new webcast today. My name is Caitlin Hansen. I'm with Church for All People and Community Development for All People in Columbus, Ohio, and I'm your host today. And I'm here with Sarah Jackson with Casa de Paz in Colorado. Tell you a little bit about her. Several years ago, Sarah went on a trip to the U.S.-Mexico border with a humanitarian aid organization working on immigration issues. She spoke with people who had been deported. She learned about people's reasons for migrating and the dangers that they face in doing so. She saw firsthand families being separated. And so then she returned to Colorado and couldn't go return to her normal life after this experience. And she decided to do something about it because she believes in that families should be together. She opened Casa de Paz, a hospitality home which offers free housing and support for families and individuals that are affected by immigrant detention. To keep the doors of La Casa open, Sarah started a volleyball league, Volleyball International. All the profits from the volleyball league is donated to Casa de Paz. They use the money to pay the rent, the utilities, food, transportation, all those operating costs. And Sarah's hope and prayer is to help end the isolating experience of immigration detention, one simple act of love at a time. So Sarah, welcome. Glad to have you with us this evening. That all sounds really fantastic. I'd love to just hear a little bit more about you and some of your journey with this work.
Sure, thank you for having me. It's always fun to be in the presence of Mennonites because the Mennonite church in Denver was actually the first church to really believe in me and what my dream of starting the Casa was going to be. And before I had even opened up the home, the Mennonites were backing me up. And so I have a soft spot in my heart for the Mennonites. And about 7 years ago, I went down to the Mexico-US border. I had grown up in the church world and never heard anything about immigrants, or I never knew that the Bible had a lot to say about how to treat immigrants when they're in your land and in your country. And I was actually working at a church in Colorado Springs, and I was the pastor's assistant. And I didn't think I knew any immigrants. Unfortunately, I kind of lived in this little bubble world. I didn't really get out of my bubble a lot. And it wasn't like I went out of my way to put myself in this little bubble. It just kind of happened to be that every one of my friends looked like me. All of my friends spoke English. It was not a very diverse life that I was living. But one morning I went to work, and one of my jobs was to go through our pastor's email in the morning and kind of sort it out, like what's junk and what's not junk. I was his assistant, so I would send everything that was super important to him. Morning with my coffee, and I was looking at the emails that he had received the day before, and one of the emails was from a group called Catholic Charities, and they were putting together a group of pastors in Colorado Springs to go down to the Mexico-US border. And the trip was more of like an educational trip, like on the border right now with immigrants, and why are people coming to the United States from other countries? And the majority of the focus, though, was what does the Bible have to say about immigrants? So, you know, I thought it sounded kind of interesting. I didn't really stay up to date on immigration. It wasn't something that was really on my radar, but the trip sounded interesting. So I sent the email to our pastor, and he received it, and he replied and basically said, "This sounds great, but I'm not going to be in town that week, so I can't go." So I saw the email again, and I read it again, and for some reason, this didn't pop out at me the first time, but the second time I read the email, I realized that it was actually a free trip to Mexico, that Catholic Charities was covering the cost of the trip. And it just seemed really, really silly that we would pass up an offer to go down to Mexico for free. So I may have said a little white lie, but I replied to Catholic Charities and I said, you know, our senior pastor isn't available to go, but I am very, very interested in learning about this. And I would love to go and learn. And then I'll report back to the pastor everything that I learned. I didn't want to go and learn. I just wanted to go to Mexico. I love to travel. And I thought it would be a fun vacation. So they replied and they said, yes, absolutely. Come with us. So I packed my bags and headed down to the Mexico-US border. We were in we spent half of our time on the Mexico side, half of our time on the US side. And we learned about different ministries and nonprofits and then just individuals who were doing stuff on the ground to alleviate some of the suffering that immigrants were experiencing. So one day we would take 55 gallon buckets of water into the desert on the U.S. desert, and we would put the water there so that the immigrants who were crossing had something to drink, so they wouldn't die just from dehydration. We spent time on the Mexico side of the border where we saw different nonprofits and ministries that were helping immigrants who had recently been deported and giving them some resources that they would need, like clothing, food, a telephone to call their family. It was a very educational trip, obviously, because I learned a lot. And you know, we learned everything from some of the policies that the United States has, which actually force migrants to leave their country, to the very basic, like, this is what the Bible actually says and how many times it actually says this about welcoming immigrants and treating them as you would treat yourself. And my mind just, you know, in that few days that I was there, it was blown away. I was completely shocked of some of the stories that I heard. And I just kind of thought it was impossible that this country that I had lived in my whole life, where I had always heard this value of families and keeping families together, it wasn't happening for people who just happened to have not been born in the United States. And it seemed so, I just had this pit in my stomach, like, this can't be happening. I mean, one of the guys that I talked to, he was in his mid-30s and he had been brought to the United States as a child. He was living in Washington State pretty much his whole life. And he went to school, he graduated high school, he ended up getting a job, marrying a US citizen woman, having three babies. And one day he was pulled over by a police officer for a speeding violation. And he was detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, by ICE. And then he was deported because it was found that he was living in the United States without papers, because his parents had brought him here as a child without papers. And I remember having dinner with him just a couple days after he had been deported, and just looking at his face and realizing, like, this isn't just like a factor figure that I'm hearing in the news. Like, this is a real person who just wants to get back to his family and be with his family. One of his kids was a little girl, a little baby, and he actually had never even met her because his wife was pregnant when he got deported. And so it was like his fourth or his fifth attempt to cross the border. And every time he was being caught by Border Patrol and being sent back, because there was really no line for him to get into, for him to be legally present in the United States. It would take him years and years and years. So he wasn't going to wait years to be with his family. And so he was just trying to cross at any means possible. And I remember looking at this guy and just thinking, well, first of all, well, honestly, my first reaction was like, this can't be true. Like, this good guy, he's not a criminal, he's never committed a crime in his life, you know, he's a hard worker, just wants to be with his family, provide and protect. Like, how is it not possible that he can be with his family? You know, he actually owned a small business, he was paying taxes, he was involved in the church and in the community. And I just, so my first reaction was like, this doesn't seem right to me. Like, is this really happening? But then my second, as I started to get to know his story, was like, totally what my dad would do. Like if my dad was in the situation as the same as this guy, stop at anything to try to get back to our, to us. And I realized that it's not really like an us versus them. It's like at the end of the day, we're all human. You know, we all have the same desires and we all want to be with our families. And so when I came back to Colorado Springs, like you mentioned, I think about it because I just couldn't ignore it. You know, I couldn't pretend that I had just had my brain like blown open and just, oh, okay, that, well, I got my little vacation, you know, and go back to my life. So that's kind of how it all started for me.
Yeah. Wow, Sarah, that's quite a story. You know, just a interesting journey to, you know, have your world kind of flipped upside down and over the course of a few couple of days. And so once you got back, what did you do about it? Would, you know, did you immediately jump into the whole Casa de Paz? Did you have conversations with the pastor? What was your kind of first course of action?
Yeah, so I got back and I knew I was gonna, my life was gonna change. I didn't know how. Wanted to change, honestly, because I was really comfortable, like in my little bubble world. Like I had a job that paid well. I had a nice car. I had a nice apartment. But I knew it was gonna change, but I didn't want it to change. And so I was like, well, I'm just gonna like take it really slow. So for about a year, I started just talking to as many people as I could about immigration, learning as much as I could, going to as many, you know, lectures or movie events, and just kind of hoping that that feeling that my life was going to change would go away because I didn't want it to change, but it didn't go away. So after a few months, I realized like I was commuting to Denver, which is about an hour away from Colorado Springs, a lot. Because Denver's just a larger city and there's more events going on up here. So I hated that I was spending so much time in traffic and spending so much money on gas. Actually working full time at this, at another company, I had switched jobs in that kind of year transition. And I went to the company and I asked them if I could work part time so that I would be able to live in Denver and then just commute a couple times down to Colorado Springs. But I told them I wanted to move up to Denver so that I could just immerse myself even more so than I had. And thankfully, it's a huge blessing. My supervisor said, yes, you can do that. So I went down to working part-time and then I just spent my days in Denver. And one of the events that I started attending was this prayer vigil that was held outside of the Immigrant Detention Center in Aurora. And, you know, little did I know that there was this detention center, and I was actually living just a few blocks away from it at the time. And I never knew that there was this detention center until a friend of mine invited me to go and be part of this prayer vigil. So I started going every month, and we would stand on the side of the street. It was at a pretty busy intersection. And the people that were gathered would hold signs, to let the community know that there was a detention center, and just to like raise awareness around what was happening in the detention center, that families were being separated, and just some of the realities that were happening in our neighborhood that not a lot of people knew about. And one of the vigils, we were standing there on the sidewalk, and I started talking to somebody, and they mentioned this hospitality home to me, and it was called El Refugio, which means the refuge. And it's a hospitality. They were telling me that it was a hospitality home in Georgia. And what they did there at this home is they opened up their home so that family members who were driving in from out of state or out of town had a place to stay while they were coming to the city to visit their mom or their dad or their brother or whoever was locked up in the detention center. So basically kind of like the Ronald McDonald home, that same concept, but for families that were affected by the detention center. The things I didn't realize is that in an immigrant detention center, you can be transferred between detention centers. So you may be caught in Tennessee by Immigration and Customs Enforcement and detained there, but then you could be transferred to Georgia or to Oklahoma or to California. You can just be transferred anywhere. And so families sometimes, oftentimes have to drive long distances or spend a lot of money on getting a plane ticket or a bus ticket to visit their family while they're in the detention center. So El Refugio was a refuge, a safe place for families to stay, where everything was provided for them, the shelter, the meals, the emotional and spiritual support. And honestly, as soon as I heard about that concept, I knew. I was like, that is what I want to do, for a couple of reasons. The first reason, which always makes me laugh now, I thought it would be easy. I was like, that's not hard. All you have to do is get a home and then open it up and let people stay with you. And really, it's not hard. There's a lot of pieces that, you know, that are involved, but it's not hard. It's not rocket science. So that was the first thing. I was like, that seems like I could do that because it's easy. And the second thing, though, the main reason was it was creating this space so that families had the ability to see each other again. Maybe driving to El Refugio and staying there while they unfortunately may have had to say goodbye to their loved one because they knew they were about to be deported. Or maybe a family was coming in from out of town to just encourage their loved one to stay strong, not to lose hope. But basically, at the end of the day, El Refugio was creating it, it was making it possible so that families could be together. And so what I did is I emailed the director of El Refugio and I asked him if I could come down there and see kind of how they do what they do. Just to, because I, you know, I didn't go to school to run a nonprofit or an organization. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. So I figured, well, it's better to just go and see how they do it and then just kind of copy it and paste it over into Colorado. So he agreed and he said, absolutely, you know, come on out. So I went down to Georgia for about 3 or 4 days. And during my time there, spent a lot of my time with the executive director and his family, and I was able to just like pick their brains and ask a billion questions on logistics, you know. And then the other half of the time I spent at the hospitality home where we hosted a family who had driven in from Texas, was detained, and it was the three kids and the mom. And in the midst of this traumatic experience of having their dad locked up and not knowing when they were going to see him again or if they would even see him again, because they didn't know if he would be deported or released, we were at the house while we were spending time together, while we were cooking meals together, while we were playing games with the kiddos, while we were just hanging out and talking. The overwhelming feeling that I got from that was peace. It felt very peaceful. They had, you know, they had been crazy just trying to scrounge up enough money to get to the house. And then once they got there, you know, they were hustling and bustling to try to get to the detention center to visit their dad. But then when they came back and we were spending time together, the feeling that I got in that home was just peace, that they were able to relax and they knew that it was a place that they could rest where people actually cared about them. So after that trip, I knew, you know, it was confirmed 100% that this is what I can do this. Like this is something I can do. So that's when I came back to Aurora, and within the next few weeks, I had found an apartment, and that's why honestly, I should have named it Apartamento de Paz because we started in an apartment, but I had always thought, you know, it would be a house. So I ended up calling it Casa de Paz, which means house of peace. And that's how kind of like one thing led to another. And that's how it came to be to just start it and open the doors.
That's fantastic. And I'm going to want to hear a lot more about the specifics of the ministry and what you all do and that sort of thing. But first, I want to know, what does volleyball have to do with immigration ministry?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it would have anything to do with it, right? It's totally random, but it has a lot to do with it. Without volleyball, we wouldn't be able to keep our doors open, because 5 or 6 months after I started the CASA, you know, like I mentioned, I was working part-time so that I had the flexibility to run the CASA. And I was eating into my savings every month. I was having to pay for everything. I was paying for the rent, the utilities, the internet, the food, and it was expensive. So I was out of my savings. I had literally pennies to my name. I remember 1 month I was looking, I mean, I was living paycheck to paycheck. I was stressed out all the time. I didn't know how I was going to pay the rent. And I remember one time I looked at my bank account and it literally, there were pennies. Like I remember laughing because I was like, I don't even have a nickel gold to my name. Like I just have pennies. And I don't think there's anything wrong with asking for money. There's nothing wrong with asking for money, but I didn't do it. I didn't ask for money. I wasn't asking for help. And so I had no money. I didn't know how to make more money because I knew if I went back to working full time, could make the money, but then I wouldn't have the time to run the classes. So I was just going to quit. I was just going to like throw up my hands and say, well, I tried, but I can't do it. You know, A for effort. But my friend at the time was very adamant that I not quit and I find a way to make some money so that we could pay the bills of the CASA. And I didn't know what to do. I'm like, well, I'm supposed to get another job or what do I do? And he asked me what else I was passionate about. He said I'm passionate about families being together, but my other passion is volleyball. I love playing volleyball. I've been playing it since I was in high school. You know, my sister went to college on a volleyball scholarship. So it's like in our family. And so he said, why don't you start a volleyball league and you charge players to play in this league? And, you know, you have a tournament at the end of the season and you've got prizes and you make it fun. But the players also realize that at the end of the day, whatever money we have left over that we've created from this league, we're going to donate it to Casa de Paz and we're going to use that to pay the rent and the utilities and the food and all of the expenses that come alongside running the CASA. A great idea, but I didn't think anyone would actually play in our volleyball league because there are a variety of volleyball leagues that have been around for many, many years in Denver. And I didn't think that anyone would be, you know, risk their money on this brand new volleyball league. But I was like, you know what? What could it hurt? It can't hurt to try. So I tried. And our very, very first season, we put out a radio ad to advertise for this volleyball league. And it cost us $2,000. And I remember that specifically because it took me a long time to save that money. We put out this radio ad. And I remember the first time that it aired, I had the phone in my hand waiting for it to like start ringing off the hook. And all these people would be signing up. You know, I was hoping that. So the ad goes on the air. And I have the phone in my hand and I'm waiting and it's silent. Like the phone isn't ringing. And I'm like, is it on or is it dead? Or is the ringer just like on silent? Like, why isn't anyone calling? I mean, the radio ad it brought in two teams. Two teams ended up registering because they heard the radio ad. But at that point I was like, this is literally the worst volleyball league in the world. Like the same two teams, like that's all we have. Like they're going to play each other every single week. We're going to get like so bored. And then like the tournament is literally going to be one game. It's just, so I was like, what? Well, I need more teams. So what I started doing is I started going to my friends that I had met, you know, in the immigrant rights community that I had made contacts with in the year that I had been living in Denver. And I went to them and I just told them what I wanted to do. I wanted to do this league and then we would raise money for the CASA. And they got it. Like they didn't have to have it explained to them at all. They were like, yeah, sign me up. Like I don't play volleyball, but sign me up. Like because I want to support the CASA. So our very first season, we ended up having six teams, which was great. And everyone was having fun. And you know, we were getting to know each other. We were becoming our own little family. And they knew it was more than just volleyball because they knew they were playing to keep the doors of Casa de Paz open. They knew their money was going to a good cause. First season, they wanted to play another season. So we played another season. And then this time, you know, instead of six teams, we had eight teams because people had been telling their friends and they were inviting their friends to join. So we just keep playing season after season after season. We play year round here in Denver. It's an indoor volleyball league. The name of our volleyball league is called Volleyball Internacional. And we have consistently over 70 teams now playing in our volleyball league. And the growth is 100% attributed to the fact, I believe, that first of all, they have fun. They're there to play volleyball and they're having fun, you know, and they're exercising, they're getting stress relief after a hard day of work. But I think that the reason that a lot of people choose to join our league versus another league in town is because they know by playing in this volleyball league, they're going to get all the benefits of joining a league, you know, having fun, competing, sweating, whatever. But their money is really changing the lives of people who are staying in our home. And it's been incredible because not only do the volleyball players go to the gym to play volleyball, but they've also, a lot of our players are now volunteering at the CASA and helping out with the guests that we have there. Or, you know, almost every week that I go to the gym, a volleyball player will bring a donation for the CASA, whether that's food or clothing or toiletries or laundry detergent, paper towels, whatever it is. So it's really incredible to see the two communities kind of like, you know, interconnect with one another.
That's fantastic. So it turns out volleyball does have a lot to do with ministry with immigrant communities. Go figure.
Yeah. Do you play volleyball?
I used to when I was in school. I enjoy it a lot, but haven't in years. Maybe I would if I were given such an incentive to contribute to a good cause like that.
You should come visit sometime.
Absolutely. And so tell us more about the ministry itself, the work of Casa de Paz and everything that you've built up in that time.
Yeah, so we do three main things at the house. The biggest part of our ministry is post-release support. So that's basically providing hospitality for men and women who have been released from the detention center and have nowhere to go. So these are people who, like I mentioned earlier, could be detained in, you know, California or Tennessee or Oklahoma, be put into a detention center in their home state and then transferred to Aurora because of either, you know, space issues, like their original detention center was crowded, so then they would have to come to, or they may be transferred. So these are people that have either been transferred in from another detention center, or these are men and women who are caught right on the border of the Mexico and US and have basically turned themselves in to Border Patrol and say, here claiming asylum, it's too dangerous to go back to my home country. And I want to do it the right way. Like I want to legally do this the right way. I'm presenting myself to an authority and I'm turning myself in. And they know that they're going to be put into a detention center where they're going to have to fight their case to stay in the United States. But that's the path that they're taking. So they're coming to the border, turning themselves into Border Patrol, filing to be an asylum seeker. And they, you know, they're put into detention centers where they're held for months, sometimes years, while the judge, and if they are lucky enough to have a lawyer, their lawyer will fight, you know, on their behalf. So the people that we end up seeing come to the CASA are people that get released, and obviously, you know, they're ecstatic that they're free because they've either won their case and now they have the legal status to live in the United States, or they have, the judge has given them a bond, and so the family or their friends pay their bond, and then they're released on bond. They're still fighting their immigration case. They still have to show up to court, you know, in front of a judge, and the judge will make the final determination. But the court is basically saying you don't have to be detained in a detention center while this case is moving along, because sometimes that can take years. So when someone gets released from the detention center, you know, if they don't have family or they don't have friends in Denver, they're homeless. They're homeless. They have nothing. They have no money. They don't have a phone to call anyone. Even if they did have a phone, they don't know anyone in Denver. So they and the detention center is actually located really close to this area of Aurora that's a little notorious for just kind of not being the best area to be stranded in. You know, some drug activity, prostitution, shootings. Like, it's not the safest place to be homeless. So of wandering the streets looking for the bus or figuring out how to get to the airport or to the bus station or whatever it is that that person would need. What we do every weekday, Monday through Friday, nobody gets released from the detention center on the weekends, but Monday through Friday, we send volunteers over to the detention center, which is about 5 minutes away from Casa de Paz. And the volunteers go into the lobby of the detention center and they basically look around and see if anyone is waiting to be picked up. It's actually pretty cool that we have a good relationship with the detention center administrators and some of the guards and the officials, because we actually give the detention center these little business cards that say, Casa de Paz is a place for men and women to stay at after they've been released from the detention center. We provide housing, food, and transportation, and it's totally free to stay at our home. And then in the card, it instructs people to wait in the lobby, and at 6 p.m., a volunteer will come pick them up and bring them over to the casa. So the officials and the guards at the detention center actually pass those cards out so that the people that need to come stay with us know to wait in the lobby, and then one of our volunteers will come and get them. So Monday through Friday, we send our volunteers over, they pick up the guests, and then they bring them back home. And then our volunteers help them coordinate kind of the logistics to get back home. So last night we had a guy from Guatemala stay in our home, and his sister lives in California. But he was released from the detention center in Aurora, and he had to figure out how to get from Aurora to California. So our volunteers got him, brought him to the house, and then they helped him communicate with his sister. So we have a phone at the home, we have a computer with internet so they can get on Skype or whatever they need. Family member that's in California or New York or Chicago, wherever it is that they are, they purchase the guest or their family a bus ticket or a plane ticket. And then once we receive confirmation that that person has their bus or their plane ticket, our volunteers go into action and to either the airport or the bus station and make sure that they get on their way safely. And yesterday, for example, the volunteer that was there at the house helped coordinate the travel logistics for our guest, and his flight didn't leave until early this morning. So in the meantime, he stayed at the house and enjoyed a nice meal with our volunteers, and then spent the night, got a nice change of clothes, took a nice shower, and then in the morning, one of our volunteers, who is actually a volleyball player in our volleyball league, he came at 3:30 in the morning, which is very, very, very early. I don't even think I would do that, he said, sure, you know, he's on spring break this week. He's a teacher. And he said, I'm not doing anything. I'll pick him up. So we came to the house at 3:30 in the morning, picked up our guest, and then took him to the airport. And then that he had taken, and, you know, he got him a cup of coffee, bought him a cup of coffee, and went with him to the gate. Like, he got a buddy pass for him to at least get through security with him so that, you know, he knows 100% that he's going to be okay. And then once he boards the plane, you know, our guest is now on the way to reunite with his family. And then our volleyball player went home and took a nap.
Yeah. Wow. So that's amazing. So at least in this particular case, it sounds like within 24 hours or shortly thereafter, this person was out, connected with their family. Their family was able to buy a last minute plane ticket, and off home he goes.
That's typically how it works, because as you can imagine, when somebody gets released from the detention center, the first thing they want to do is get to their family. So their family normally tries to get them the first plane out of there. So sometimes guests actually come to our home and they don't even spend the night. They just stay for a couple hours until their flight leaves, and then our volunteers take them. Sometimes people end up staying a few days. Last week we had a lady from Haiti who stayed at our home, and it took her family several days to gather enough money just to buy her ticket. So in the meantime, she was with us for about 5 days as her family coordinated all of that. And so she stayed with us a little bit longer, but on average people stay one, maybe two nights. And then sometimes we also have family members come and stay in our home as well. that's actually started the CASA was basing it off of El Refugio, which was to invite families to come stay when they were traveling in from out of town. And what ended up happening is that a family would come and they would stay at the, well, when I first started the house, it was in an apartment. We just a couple months moved into an actual home. But what's happening is family members were coming and staying with me and my apartment. And then they, you know, they'd be in town for a couple of days to visit their dad or their mom or their sister, whoever was detained. And then they would leave. They would go back home to California or to Nebraska or wherever. And, you know, during the time that the family stayed in my apartment, I had become friends with them. And when they left, I knew that they were leaving their family back in Aurora, you know, back here. And I just started offering because, you know, I knew that their dad was going to be stuck in detention. Nobody was going to be there to visit him. He'd just be stuck in his room 24/7. So I started offering to visit the family members of the families that stayed with me. And for about 3 or 4 months, I started visiting different people, you know, every week. And at one point I was visiting like 7 or 8 different guys. They all happened to be guys of families, members that had stayed with me at my house. And I was the only one at that time involved in our visitation ministry. I didn't even see it as a ministry or, you know, anything big at that point. I just thought I was just visiting people to, you know, keep them from being bored and just check in on them and see how they were doing. But I was visiting this one week in particular. I was visiting a different guy every day. And the same guard at the detention center was checking me in every day and taking my IDs and giving me my visitor badge and all of that. And it was like the 6th or the 7th visit that week that I had done. And he knew me because I was coming every day. And then he also started to realize that I was visiting different guys every single time. And so it was like on a Friday afternoon, you know, after I had seen him for like 4 or 5 times that week. And he just kind of stopped. Like he took my ID, he was putting it in the computer, all my information. And then he just stopped and he was like, "Who are you? Like, what are you doing here? Like, why are you visiting all these different random guys? Like, I need to know what's going on." And so I was like, "Okay, well, here's what's happening. Like, my name is Sarah. I live across the street in an apartment. Family members are welcome to come to my apartment and stay with me for free when they're coming in from out of town. And then when they leave, I volunteer to visit their family that they've left behind. So that's what I'm doing." And then he just had this like, kind of this like, I mean, it was an audible sigh. He was like, "Oh, okay." And I was like, "Why? What's wrong?" And he was like, "Well, that's good to know because I thought that you were dating all these guys." And I was like, no, that's not what's happening. So that's actually where the visitation ministry came from, is I was like, that's not the reputation that I want. So then I started bringing friends with me. So I would bring my friend Preston with me, and Preston and I would visit, you know, Tony together. And then we would leave. And then the next time Tony needed a visit, Preston would go visit him, you know. So little by little, I was inviting one friend and another friend. And that's kind of how the visitation ministry got started. And then from there, that's actually where we started the post-release support, because we had a group of about 6 or 7 individuals who were visiting people in the detention center. And sometimes those people that they were visiting would get released. And when they got released, they would call whoever was visiting them and they would tell them the good news that they had been released and they were free. And, you know, all of those people that we had been visiting, their family lived far away. So we knew that they needed a place to stay while they were waiting for their family to pick them up or for them to get a bus or a plane to get home. So that's where the post-release support thing kind of came into play. It was not like an intentional, this is what we want to do. It just happened that, you know, we found out people were getting released. And so the natural thing to do would be to invite them over because the apartment was, you know, within walking distance. So those are the three main things that we do, is the post-release support, the visitation ministry, and then also having the family members come and stay with us.
So just a simple little visit vacation to Mexico, huh?
I thought that's what it was. Like literally when I was replying to Catholic Charities, I envisioned myself in Mexico on the beach with a piña colada and like putting sunscreen on my body, like getting a tan. I didn't get a piña colada. I didn't go to the beach. I didn't get a tan. But I did get to travel. I did have a new experience. And honestly, I even though I wasn't going down there to have my life changed or any, I had no idea that it would end up being like this. I'm so thankful that I went down there with, you know, that I just had the opportunity to go, because I love what I do. I love what I do. And I am so satisfied with the work that I do at the CASA and with volleyball. I don't even know what I would have done, you know, with my life had I not had this opportunity. But yeah, that trip to Mexico ended up getting a little more intense than I thought it would.
Yeah, that's just such a beautiful story. So front and center on Casa de Paz's website says hospitality matters. Can you just speak a little bit? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, so I remember this one time I was 18 or 19 years old, and I was traveling back from home to Colorado. I had gone down to Texas to visit some of my friends, and I got stuck in Arizona. My flight got delayed, and then for a mechanical reason, I ended up in the airport of Phoenix, and I didn't think I knew anyone in Phoenix. I was stuck and I was stranded. I was going to have to sleep in the airport. And I was just feeling like sad that like I was just stranded and didn't have anyone to help me in my moment of, you know, of need. And then my mom ended up calling me and she was like, "Hey, I have some friends that actually live in Phoenix. Let me call them and see if they could pick you up from the airport and let you spend the night at their house, so you don't have to spend the night in the airport." And I was like, okay, but I didn't think anyone would do that. Like I didn't know the family. I had never met them before. I'm like, well, it's a long shot, but let's try. So my mom ended up calling his family and they said, absolutely. You know, we'll go get Sarah. We'll pick her up from the airport. We'll bring her back home. They fed me a delicious meal. I had this huge bed that was so comfortable with these pillows that were really fluffy and clean sheets. And it meant so much to me that somebody who didn't know me, who had nothing to gain by helping me, would go out of their way to make sure that I was comfortable. And that, for me, that feeling of knowing that somebody is taking care of you when there's nothing in it for them to gain, it made me feel important and special. Like it made me feel like that I mattered, you know? That they would go out of their way to help me in my time of need. And so the way that I mentioned earlier, like this is so not difficult. Like it's not anything super hard that we're doing, but when we bring people to our home and we're telling them that they matter to us and that we care about them with the little things, you know, like with the meal, with the healthy home-cooked meal, with a fresh set of sheets on the bed and a clean towel and a little goodie bag of treats to take with them when they leave. Little bitty things like that can remind people that they have value and dignity and they're important and their life matters. And so many times people will come to the CASA and completely stressed out before they get to the house because they're wondering, what's going to happen to me? I just got out of the detention center, but what do I do? I don't know anyone. Am I going to be sleeping on the streets? You know, in Colorado, we have crazy weather. One day it can be 70 degrees and the next day it can be a blizzard. So if somebody's released in the middle of a blizzard, like it's a very stressful situation to be in when you don't know where you're going to sleep that night or if you're going to have food or how you're going to get home. You know, the basic things out of love, like, we don't know, we've never met these people before in our lives, but because of, well, for me, my faith, You know, I am supposed to treat my neighbor the same way that I would treat myself. And I don't say this flippantly because I believe it, but like, and this, I mean, it sounds kind of bad, but honestly, like, I do love myself a lot. Like I do. Like, I care about myself. Like, if I'm hungry, I will feed me. If I'm thirsty, I will find something to drink. If I'm cold, I will find a coat. And if I claim to be a follower of Christ, and that's a command that I'm given, and if I don't do that, like, what does that, then why do I say that I follow Jesus if I don't listen to the words that I'm being told on what to do? So when the Bible says, love your neighbor as yourself, like, it's for me pretty cut, you know, supposed to do. Like, we treat each other the way that we would want to be treated. So the hospitality of the, you know, the basic simple things that we do at the Casa is simple, but it can speak volumes to someone. And I mean, just a few days ago, we actually had a guy, his name's David, and he's from El Salvador, and he came to the United States to be with his family. He was living in El Salvador, and it just got too dangerous for him to live there. There was constant fighting, people getting murdered in his city because of the gang violence there. And he ended up getting released from the detention center, and he came over to the house where he stayed a couple of days until he got all of his travel arrangements to get reunite with his family. The day that he left, he wrote us this beautiful note, this beautiful thank you note, and he said, long story short, basically, thank you for having such a beautiful place like the Casa. That's it's a home that's filled with such love. And then at the very end, he said, life in the United States began here at Casa de Paz. And to know that, like, we have the ability to welcome immigrants to our city and to our country, and to make them feel like we want them and we need them and they're important, it's powerful.
Yeah, that is really powerful. The message that sends is people having their first encounters. And maybe even countering the narrative that they've experienced to that point. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could tell, so you talked about loving thy neighbor and that sort of thing. What else does scripture tell us about welcoming the stranger and the foundations for exactly what you are doing?
Well, over and over and over, honestly, the theme that I find is treating the foreigner, treating the stranger as we would treat a citizen, same way. And not requiring, you know, legal proof that they're, you know, legally present. You know, it's like Jesus didn't say, love your neighbor as yourself if they're documented, if they came through the legal way, if they're, you know, XYZ. It's just love someone the same way that you would love your, you know, love yourself or love your treat other people in your community. And the basic stuff too, the visitation ministry, for example, when Jesus says, when I was in prison and you visited me, or I was sick and you, or I was naked and you clothed me, or I was hungry and you fed me. Those are principles that we try, you know, to accomplish when people come and stay at our home. And it doesn't matter, you know, what your religion is or what your faith is or where you came from or what legal status you have, and is open to anyone. You know, anyone is allowed to stay at the home. Just the same way that, like, God's love isn't conditional. God loves, you know, we welcome everyone at the Casa.
I'm reminded what our pastor always teaches us about the word hospitality, that the Greek word for hospitality is translated from, it is philoxenia, and it turns out it's a compound word. I won't stay too long in the Greek, but the compound word is phila, which means love, like Philadelphia, city of brotherly love, and xenia, which is the Greek word for stranger. And so hospitality, when literally translated, means love of the stranger. And that sounds like exactly what you are doing.
I had no idea. I didn't know that's what it meant.
Well,
that's so cool.
There's our Greek lesson for the day. Pastor John will be so proud.
Thank you, Pastor John.
I'm wondering, just as you talk about the visits that you and your volunteers do, tell us a little bit about what those are like, what that experience is like.
Yeah, so the very first time I actually did a visit was down in El Refugio. I remember going to El Refugio, driving there with Anton, who was at that time the executive director. And we got to El Refugio, we put away our bags and we kind of settled in. And then he said, well, do you want to go to the detention center? And I was like, sure. You know, I thought he was just around and look at it, you know, and I wanted to see what a detention center looked like. So we got in the car, we started driving to the detention center, and then he parked in the parking lot. And I remember thinking, why are we parking? Like, we're just driving by to see the detention center. Why is he parking? And I was like, okay. So I got out of the car and I'm like, what are we doing? Like, are we just going to walk around? Or, and then we started walking towards the entrance of the detention center. And I was like, are we going inside? And then he turned around and he gave me this piece of paper. And on the piece of paper, it had this name. I didn't know who it was, but it had a name of a guy and then some numbers after his name. And I was like, going to stand outside the detention center and like pray for this guy? Or like, what's happening here? Well, no, it ended up that we were there to do a visit. And I had never visited anyone in a detention center before. I had never been inside a detention center or a prison or a jail or anything. But Anton was like, yeah, we're going to go visit some people. And I was like, what do I do? Like, I don't know what to talk about. Like, what do I say? I was nervous. I didn't, but we didn't have any time because we went in, we checked in with the guard, and then right away they took us to the visitation room. So I was like, oh my gosh, what's happening? I was so nervous. I had no idea what the experience was going to be like, but it ended up being so, important, because the guy that I visited had been locked up for several months and he had nobody had come by and visited him because he didn't have family or friends in the area. So he was just sitting in his dorm, in his pod every day. Going to get released today? Am I going to get deported today? He was hopeless. He had started losing hope. He was being, you know, he's starting to get depressed, just sad, you know, not being able to enjoy life, you know, because he's in a detention center. And when I went and I started talking to him, we talked about soccer, we talked about food, we talked about what we did on Thanksgiving, holidays, like family traditions. It was interesting because I ended up talking about some situation in my life. I think I had just broken up with a boyfriend and I was sad. And he started encouraging me to like stay strong and like don't be sad. But you know, it was a little awkward, not going to lie. Like the first time you visit someone, like you don't really know what they're going to say or what they're going to talk about. And there's always like that awkward silence every once in a while where you're just like, so what's your favorite color, you know? But at the end of our time together, we had about an hour together. I remember he said, thank you for coming and visiting me because Ed in a different place. You gave me hope, basically, is what he was saying. Because out of his dorm room and go to a different section of the detention center to get out, just to have a break, a change up in his routine. And then to realize that there was somebody in the outside world who cared about him enough to visit him, to take time out of their day to stop by and just say, hey, how are you doing? And really, you know, our visitors that go and do the visits, they're not They're not social workers. They're not a financial support. They're just a friendly person stopping by to let that person that they're visiting know you matter. You're not forgotten about. People know you're here. You've not been forgotten about. And what ends up happening just by spending an hour with someone, their hope is renewed. I went to a visitation program retreat a couple years ago in California. There's visitation ministries all across the country. And so we were having a retreat in California to like learn from one another and to share ideas and best practices and all of that good stuff. And there was actually a guest speaker who was a lady who had received visits during her, I think she was detained for like a year. And she was receiving different visits from different people. And she shared her story with us. She ended up writing a book about it, her time in detention. And she shared her story with us. And at the end of her presentation, we were able to ask her questions. The audience asked her, why was getting a visit so important to you? What was it? What's the one thing about it that you would say was most important to you? Without even hesitating, she said, they gave me hope. They gave me a reason to get out of bed the next day, to keep fighting. And it seems like something so simple, like you just go and you spend, you know, an hour with someone and hang out and talk to them about life. And if they want to pray, you pray with them. If they just want to talk, you listen. If they just want to listen, you talk. That it can be the difference between someone feeling and someone feeling forgotten about. You know, we've visited people before who tried to kill themselves because they were so depressed being locked up in detention centers. I mean, they'd never committed a crime in their life and treated like a criminal just simply because they came to the United States in search of a better life. We had one lady who was starving herself so that her baby, because she didn't want her baby to, if she ended up getting deported, she didn't want her baby to live in the conditions that she was living at in her home country. It was that bad. And we've seen lives being transformed by the simple fact that someone took time out of their day to go visit that person and to let them know that they have value. And it's incredible to see people whose attitudes can change so drastically just because they got a little attention. And on the flip side too, for us visitors that are going into the detention center and visiting people, for me, every time I go in and I visit someone, I wrestle with what having privilege means. Like, there's this young lady that we're visiting now almost 2 years. She's from Mexico. She has a very similar past to mine. You know, she was a victim of domestic violence and she fled her country to escape her abuser. And she just wanted to come to a place that was safe for her. And now she's in a detention center to fight and win her case to stay. One time I went and I visited her and we were talking and we were just recipes from that our mothers had taught us to cook several, you know, different kinds of meals. And when I left the detention center, you know, I got into my car and it was a nice spring day. So I rolled the windows down and I was driving through the streets and my hair was blowing in the wind and I was listening to music. I'm like, why do I have this privilege of being able to leave the detention center and go on with my normal life when this lady who I just visited, you know, is the same person, is the same kind of person. You know, she's just a regular person who just wants to be free, you know, and get out there again and enjoy life. And so it keeps keeps me motivated to keep, to be aware that I have privilege and instead of living in the guilt of privilege, like, what am I going to do with that? You know?
Absolutely. And so, Sarah, as folks are listening to you, listening to your story, listening to the sort of work you do, what message do you have for those that are maybe just becoming aware of some of these issues and the complexities around them, or even for those that maybe feel some resistance to some of the things that you're talking about, some of the work that you do? What might you have for those folks?
The one thing that I would recommend to anyone who's just starting to learn or has questions is to intentionally put yourself in a situation where you meet someone who has been affected by immigrant detention or by the border's policies of separating families. Because you can read books, you can go to movies, you can do your research, but everything will change when you meet a real person. When you are sitting across the table, talking face to face, I think that is the most important thing that you can do, is put yourself in the same room as someone and hear their story. Because I think it would be really difficult to ignore a story that you just heard. You know, it makes it real instead of, like I mentioned earlier, just something you hear about on the news or whatever. And then the second thing that I would say is it's okay to have questions. And honestly, and I know this sounds really embarrassing to admit, but it is what it is. When I first started, even after my trip on the border, when I came back and I was wrestling for like that year and learning and doing as much as I could, there were days where I would wake up and I was like, wait a minute, like all of these people that are here without papers, like they're breaking the law. Like there were moments where I was like, well, kick everybody out and build the wall higher. Like that makes sense. Like I was a very black and white person. And honestly, I believe it was a miracle, because one day I woke up and the scripture became alive for me, where it says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. That took on a completely different meaning for me one morning. That's why I consider it to be a miracle. But it changed. I mean, so I think it's important to find people that you can ask those questions to and not feel embarrassed, or not be afraid that you may be, you know, looked at as, oh, I can't believe they thought that or they're thinking that. And there are so many good resources out there too. And I know the Mennonites have done, have put out some really good stuff too on immigrants and what the Bible has to say about immigration and all of response to them as Christians. So yeah, I would say, like, put yourself in a situation where you can meet someone and hear their story, and then also find a safe space where you can dialogue and ask questions with a group or with one person.
Yeah, that's great. You know, just digging deep and finding that new information, you know, helping our own selves learn about that. Then I think you're totally right, you know, making it personal. Find an individual that has been affected, whether directly or someone in their family, and listening to those stories is so powerful and makes all the difference in the world. And so, Sarah, appreciate you sharing your stories with us. Maybe as we draw to a close, you can direct our viewers to where they can find more information about your work, and also if there's a way that folks can contribute and donate, be sure that we know where to go for that.
Yeah, so we have a website. It's www.casadepazcolorado. So that's CASADEPAZ colorado.org. And on the website, there's a information about what we provide, our values, our mission, and then there's also a link there to donate. And all the money that we receive from donations goes directly to pay our rent. And then we also are on Facebook under Casa de Paz. Updated with us there. On the website, there's also a link where you can sign up for our monthly newsletter, where we just share stories of some of the guests that have stayed with us, some stuff that's been happening around town. So you can stay connected with us that way.
Great. Thanks so much, Sarah, for joining us and for sharing all of this great information and really touching stories about the work you're doing and the folks that the lives that you're touching. Really wonderful. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, everyone. This is Paul Walker. If you like what you just heard, be sure to check out more of what we have to offer at menonerds.com. It's the hub for all things MenoNerds. From there, you can learn more about these podcasts, syndicated blogs from people all over the world, books authored by some of our members, and a host of other exciting free resources for you and your church. Now, there's one last thing. What we do costs a bit of money, and we're always doing it on a volunteer basis. We have people that are committed to making this happen, but we could use more people. If you like what we do, please consider donating monthly. We have two options. You can either do a monthly donation through Patreon, or you can give a one-time donation at any time through PayPal. We love the work we do, but we do need your help to keep it going and to expand into new territory. If you would like to donate, check out menonerds.com/donate. Thanks for listening, and as always, have a great day.